All right, so who had three games in the coach's firing pool? A lot of us had Peter Laviolette in the coach's firing pool. I don't think that was a huge surprise to see him get turfed by the Philadelphia Flyers as head coach, replaced by Craig Berube today. But who had three games in the pool, Jeff Merrick?
Denny Savard. he didn't want to hold the record of four games anymore. By the way, I'm guesting on the podcast today. I'm your third guest on the podcast today, as you can tell.
Jeffy is in Stouffville. The equipment is failing. The storms are coming through. And naturally, this occurs on a day when there's nothing going on the show other than having Bruce Boudreau and Keith Jones on.
It's infuriating, but at least, you know, our tech crew is on it. That's the main thing.
Yes,
I'm not going to air out all the laundry here on the podcast, but the help has been underwhelming.
A crack staff of experts working round the clock to fix your tie line problems there.
Yeah.
Well, anyways.
Things
could be worse. You could have been fired by the Flyers. The Laviolette firing to me is frustrating on several fronts, none the least that I'm a rather big Peter Laviolette fan. I feel like last year was, in fact, an anomaly with the injuries piling up from the blue line to the front line with Hartnell going out without the Flyers replacing Jágr's points on the Drew line, the goaltending being what it is. But if I'm a Flyers fan, my biggest point of frustration is that if you're going to do it, and it seems like Paul Holmgren if he didn't have his mind made up, at least the thought was entertained to make a change. Doing this change three games into the season means that it is three games later than having the chance to sign John Tortorella, Alain Vigneault, Lindy Ruff, Dallas Eakins, or any number of other coaches that were available that now have jobs while the Flyers are figuring out what they wanted to do with Laviolette.
The key there outside of Dallas Eakins is you had a chance to hire a veteran guy. And here's one of my concerns if I'm a Philadelphia Flyers fan. And I don't know how Craig Berube is going to do. I really don't have a clue. But what I do know is the Philadelphia Flyers team needs a lot of help, needs a jolt. You know, well, what they actually wish, you know what they need? They need goals. They got three goals in three games, okay? They lose to Toronto 3-1, 4-1 to Montreal, and 2-1 to Carolina. This team needs goals. That's why you wonder why players like Phil Kessel get $8 million a year on their extensions. It's because goals are expensive, and goals will cost you, will cost coaches their jobs if they can't get it, much like save. Goals and saves, I know it sounds simple, but goals and saves will save your job. If you're the Philadelphia Flyers now, you are going into this season three games deep, 0-3, with a rookie head coach, with a brand new guy.
Yeah.
It is a gamble. I know they know him. He's been part of the Philadelphia Flyers organization for a number of years, but you are still going in there with a new guy. You're not going in there with Ruff, with Tortorella, with Vigneault. You are going in there with Craig Berube. He might do well, he might not. All I know is we don't know. And at this point, if you're the Philadelphia Flyers, should you take that gamble? Should you take that chance?
No, I don't think that you necessarily should, but I guess they feel that Berube is part of the Flyers tradition. And that was the other real big interesting point from today's press conference and introducing Berube, brief as it was the accusations of the Flyers being insular in their hiring process. And mm-hmm. I think it's an accusation that is levied as a criticism of the organization, but I don't necessarily think it is. Like, Terry Murray had a history with the Flyers before he was hired. Ken Hitchcock mm-hmm. was an assistant coach with the Flyers before he was hired. Laviolette had nothing to do with the franchise and turned out to be pretty good, bringing in an outsider's perspective to the organization. I don't necessarily think hiring a guy who's come through the Flyers organization is the myopic option that some people do. That said, you're right. This is handing a guy a shovel who you're not exactly sure can dig yourself out of the ditch.
Well, here's another issue to all of it. Everybody always, you know, whenever the Montreal Canadiens have a coaching vacancy, it's, the Montreal Canadiens won't go for the best coach. They'll go for the best French coach available. And they're accused of being insular and, you know, and just looking, you know, within the French-speaking coaching community, and they get blasted for it.
Yeah.
But if you're the Philadelphia Flyers and, you know, your plane is as narrow as, well, did it wear orange? Okay, we'll hire it. Somehow that gets a free pass and they are building culture. whereas Montreal gets just destroyed
now,
and decimated for a century, doing the same thing and shortening the talent, or shallowing the talent pool.
Now, all that said, it is a little disconcerting, even as a guy who is defending Ed Snyder on this front, to look at the Flyers organizational chart right now and see Craig Berube, head coach, see Paul Holmgren, GM, see Ron Hextall, assistant GM, see Shel Samuelson, director of player personnel, see Darian Hatcher, a scout, see Chris Pronger, a scout, or whatever he is. It literally is like taking a roster from about 10 years ago and then just plopping different names into positions on the staff chart.
But here's why I don't have a problem with it. Because whether you're, you know, a general manager or a coach or a, you know, director of player personnel, you always surround yourself with A, people you know because you're familiar with them and you know you can work with them, and B, people you can trust. So I don't necessarily, because it happens in every business, and it's smart business as well. Bring in people whose work ethic you know. How do you know it? Because you've worked with them before. It makes complete sense to me. Like, I understand it completely. I don't necessarily think it is the most ridiculous thing to do, because you bring in someone just from the outside based on reputation and what they did before. You never work with them. All you know is, all you hear is, you know, secondhand news of, oh, he didn't get along well with this guy, and this guy in the goalie had a problem. You're just going on secondhand information as opposed to intimate knowledge of someone you've worked with before. That's
right.
Why I never have a problem with them going inside and hiring people whose, you know, work ethic, personality traits, all of it, they're already well acquainted with. I guess zero problem with it.
The other really interesting conversation that was born out of that press conference today was about Flyers culture. And it was related to hiring Berube to be the coach, and it was a question of whether or not you wanted to bring in outsiders to help change the culture of the Flyers. To this point, Ed Snyder bristled because he doesn't believe that the Flyers' culture is that of a losing culture. And again, I understand there's going to be a lot of criticism of him for saying things like, you know, we don't have to go outside the organization to get anybody, you know, we don't have to get an outsider, all that stuff. But from the perspective of defending the Flyers' culture of one that is not a losing culture, again, I stand with the chairman on this argument. I don't think that the Flyers, having made the playoffs every year but two since 95, having made the conference final, I think it's six times, I might be wrong on that, and making the cup final twice during that span, I don't know how you look at that and say it's a culture of losing. Now, granted, it's not a culture of winning the cup like other teams did. I mean, clearly the Devils and the Red Wings and the Penguins and the Blackhawks all have legacies that I think the Flyers would be envious of. But the idea that culture needs to change to what exactly?
Yeah, it is really interesting the way that this is a team that consistently, year in and year out, of course, they're on the odd one-off years where they don't make the playoffs, maybe get lucky in the lottery, and bump up their draft position. But this is a team that consistently, right, can say, you go back to like 1967 expansion, after they learned their lesson by taking the lumps against the St. Louis Blues for a couple of years, when they finally turned things around, this team never looked back. Like, when you go back to the great expansion of 1967, who would you say the most successful franchise is? I know they haven't won a Stanley Cup since 1975, but they did win back-to-back, and they're the first expansion team to win the Stanley Cup. But if you look consistently, who has been the most successful franchise? You can say Pittsburgh because they've won the most cups, but I could make the argument, I think many could as well, that it's Philadelphia.
Well, I mean, obviously the answer is the California Golden Seals. I mean, we all know that to be true.
Well, because that begat the Cleveland Barons with some great jerseys and great goalie face masks as well.
Right, who then merged with the Minnesota North Stars, and then the whole circle was complete.
You know what? By the way, a great line about that. Sam Pollock, then general manager of the Montreal Canadiens, there was a big aversion to the Cleveland Barons team being absorbed by the Minnesota North Stars. You know what his quote was? Because he didn't care. He's like, because Minnesota was a bad team at that point too. His line was, so what? I'm going to paraphrase here. one piece of shit merges with another piece of shit, it's still a piece of shit. That's the legendary. That is the legend of Sam Pollock, ladies and gentlemen. And what do you thought of that organization, that franchise? Yeah, it's great.
No, your argument about the 67 expansion is an interesting one. I mean, as far as consistency goes, I think the St. Louis Blues would be in the conversation, having made the playoffs for what was, what, about 25, 30 consecutive seasons?
27
the hell
years
it was.
In a row, was it?
27
years
in a row. 27 years
something like that? Yeah, it was crazy.
But they didn't really do anything is the point. The Flyers-Penguins argument's an interesting one in the sense that the Penguins have more cups. The Penguins have more legendary players produced in the franchise's history. I think the count would be up to 5, would you say?
You would say Mario. He was pretty good. You would say Sidney. You would say Jágr. You would say Malkin. Am I missing anyone?
Yeah, 4 maybe.
John Cullen?
John Cullen.
No? Pierre LaRouche.
Stackhouse
is throwing that mix as well.
Anyways, the Penguins, you could make an argument for, but as far as the cups and consistency, never really having to go into the deep tank as the Penguins have done twice in their history. Yeah. I would agree with you that the Flyers are probably the best of the 67 expansion teams.
You know, it will be framed that it was a three-game audition for Peter Laviolette, but it sounded as if they had a good feeling about this at training camp and through the preseason as well. What did Snyder say today? The worst training camp he's ever seen?
Oh, yeah. They went 1-8-1 under Laviolette this year, if you count the preseason. So something was afoot, clearly. Well, all right. So what do you do to fix the Flyers? That's actually our question of the day. At Wyshynski, at Jeff Merrick on Twitter, hashtag at MVSW, puckdaddyblog@yahoo.com is the email address. How, Jeff Merrick, would you go about trying to fix the Philadelphia Flyers?
I don't think it's a quick fix. I think, you know, the two key problems, not that necessarily goaltending has been their biggest issue, but goaltending is an issue for the Philadelphia Flyers, and it has been since Kelly Lindbergh. Since Ron Hextall. Ron Hextall was the last great one that they had. And that blue line completely changed. Like, everything changed the Philadelphia Flyers organization when Chris Pronger went down. And Chris Pronger's career, although it's not official yet, wink, wink, he's still on LTI, so he can spend above the cap, when Chris Pronger's career ended with his injury. Every single thing changed. I mean, a player like Chris Pronger, I mean, Pronger is a great eraser. You know, we look at, you know, goaltenders are namely the great eraser of the game. You know, a lot of mistakes get covered up when you have a great goaltender. You could also make the argument Chris Pronger was as much of an eraser as any elite-level goaltender. Things just settled down. The puck got out of the zone. Everything was different with big Chris Pronger in the lineup. And that's not Peter Laviolette's fault. That's not his problem at all. But the whole defense needs to be reconstructed. And it may cost them one of the young forwards. I love the young forwards. They should be able to score by the buckets. They're tough enough as well. But it may cost them one of those young forwards to get a defenseman or to get a goaltender. Or
that
maybe two of those players.
That really is the point for me, too. You know, you talk about this team. You talk about Timonen being in the last year of his contract. Mm-hmm. Streit's obviously there for a while. Coburn signed for 3 more years. They're done with Mazaros after this year. Shen's there, Grossman's there. They have to go get the stud D-man, the Weber type that they were going for. They have to go try to get that guy by any means necessary. And by any means necessary is going to mean eventually, or potentially at the very least, trading either Braden Shen or Sean Couturier. I think Reed will be there for a little bit. Obviously, they like him enough to sign him to an extension. But it means trading one of those guys to dramatically improve your blue line, which is where the improvement has to happen. You can listen, the Flyers have shown throughout the years, and this is an ingrained part of Flyers culture, that you can have average goaltending if you have something playing in front of that average goaltending. They just don't. And the whole bottom fell out last year when it was Bryzgalov and Mason, or whoever the hell was behind Bryz before Mason came to town, behind a blue line that was a patchwork AHL core of defensemen. And I don't have any faith in that goalie tandem this year playing behind that defense. So
the goalie has goaltending really been their problem though.
The problem is they can't
score goals.
Not so far, no. But in the long run, I think it's going to be a huge issue.
I don't disagree with you at all. Not whatsoever. The problem though is the Philadelphia Flyers just cannot score goals. They just can't wish, and there's just no way around that. And that's bizarre when you look at the potential firepower this team should have up front. I honestly don't get it. I don't get it.
Speaking of firing, I mean, this is obviously the easiest fix for the Flyers. Paul Holmgren's got to go. I mean, the construction of this team since the Cup years.
It's so obvious that he will. I mean, the moment they brought in Ron Hextall, the writing was on the wall. Oh, by the way, just as an aside, just prediction time. As much as we say they'll need a goaltender and a defenseman, how much you want to bet that it's Camilleri for Coburn? When Camilleri comes back to the Flames organization at the end of the month, that's the deal that Philadelphia Flyers go out and make.
Or Glenn Cross or one of those cats from the forward group for sure.
Yeah,
no question. Yeah.
Yep.
No, the writing's on the wall. You're absolutely right. And this move to me is so hasty as to try to save Holmgren's job. I mean, you obviously pull the trigger as quickly as possible to try to right the ship as best you can. Mm-hmm. But the writing's on the wall for that. And you know, it's the interesting line to be drawn for the Flyers since their Cup final appearance, and since we've all seen what's happened since that appearance, is who do you blame? How much of the trading of Richards and Carter, the signing of Bryzgalov, Vinny, the Weber offer sheet, how much of that can you go upstairs to Ed Snyder's office and say that's his call? And how many of these things can you go to Paul Holmgren's office and say it was his call?
Richards and Carter, I would pin more so on the owner than the general manager, and ditto for Ilya Bryzgalov. Like the one thing about Ed Snyder, and some people like this style of ownership, it makes things more interesting, certainly, than a faceless corporation or a board of directors. But the Bryzgalov, remember that era so specifically, it wasn't that long ago. Tim Thomas leads the Boston Bruins to the Stanley Cup, and Snyder says, why don't we have that? Go get our guy. Who's on the landscape? Who's out there? Well, there's this guy in Phoenix. That's our guy. Go get him. Throw $50 million at him, Homer. Like, that's an Ed Snyder decision, and the decision to get rid of Carter and Richards. Like, when you think about it, Greg, when have you ever seen a Stanley Cup final team? Now, you can maintain, oh, it was 2010, the Montreal, you know, the fluky Montreal Canadiens did all the heavy lifting for the Flyers that year by getting rid of Pittsburgh and the Washington Capitals. But when have you seen a team that, you know, reached Game 6 of the Stanley Cup final get dismantled so quickly?
Yeah.
Through botched trades.
Botched trades, but also, you know, also we've got a little bit of the Pronger thing going on there, too,
that's
and what
big.
Have you.
That's huge. Yep.
Yeah.
That's big.
I think it's a fixable situation. I think, obviously, I'm a big Claude Giroux fan, so I think that's a good piece to build around.
Yep.
But they got a long ways to go, and like you, I'm a little skeptical as to whether or not Craig Berube is the man to dig him out of the ditch.
It's funny. You know, the one main game, so I've watched, you know, bits and pieces of the other two, and yesterday afternoon I get to watch a bunch. I only watched a little bit of the Montreal Canadiens game, but that the Maple Leafs game, like the home opener, like they dominated play. Like, they dominated the Toronto Maple Leafs. But every chance was right into the middle of the goaltender.
Mm-hmm.
Did not have to make, you know, great saves at all. Like, Jonathan Bernier did not have to make great saves at all in that game. Although, if you look at the statistics, the rink is tilted Philadelphia's direction.
Mm-hmm.
Like, generating chances was generating quality chances. Just wasn't there.
Right. And then one of the first things Ruby said today was, you know, we're going to get better away from the puck, better defensively. They have given up 9 goals in 3 games as well. So, I don't know. It was a move we all thought was going to happen, but probably not this soon. And Peter Laviolette will land on his feet.
I don't imagine
he'll be out of work for that long.
No. This guy is going to be back in the NHL quicker than you can say Jack DeBeer. This guy is back fast.
And quicker than you can say Minnesota Wild.
Come on, really?
Dude, the Mike Yo watch has started. I saw more people tweeting at me today about, where's Lobby going to land? Well, you know, we give Mike Yo until December until this thing's... I'm like, dude just got a team that was ahead of schedule into the playoffs last year. Now everybody's calling for his head. Because I think people see Mike Yo as the type of coach that you fire to then hire the better coach to get you over the hump and become a contender. Like, I always thought that's how people view this guy, as maybe not having the chops to coach a champion, but having the chops to coach a team that starts to become a champion.
Yeah, maybe. But, I mean, he was there with the Pittsburgh Penguins during their championship run, though, wasn't he? Like,
he
I know
was.
He wasn't the guy. He wasn't the guy calling the shots. But
no, he wasn't.
he has been around that kind of greatness before. But I'm with you. Like, Minnesota has to improve on last season. So A, get into the playoffs, and B, they have to win a round.
There you go.
All right. Make the decision out of that early. Jeez, hey, Ron Rolston's 0-3. How about him too?
Give him 0-3 and 2 goals on the season, sir. Two goals. On the season. 0 for like 13 on the power play so far for Buffalo as well. So
yeah, things are
really good up there. Sir, are you going to try to hop on the old tie line and come back on the show? Or?
Yeah, I've been trying, but it keeps dropping out.
Right.
I don't know. I've been trying to get my tie line problem fixed here for a while, but
maybe
there's people that just don't want to seem to make it happen.
Maybe we hear you later. Maybe we don't. We're going to hear Bruce Boudreau in a second. That's exciting.
I know, you got Gabby. I'd love to hear from Gabby. And then later on, you got Jonesy. You got some great hockey nicknames here. You got Bruce Boudreau and Keith Jones coming up. This is an awful show to miss.
Do you want to stay on the phone with Gabby? Matt Brown says that you can if you want.
How will it sound?
It sounds fine, right? I think it will.
That sounds crappy, man.
Here, no. Stay on the phone for Gabby. We'll see how it goes.
I'm happy to do it. I'm happy to do it.
We're going to do it, man. It's important, I think, probably.
Sure.
And Matt, here's what Maddie says. It sounds better than not having you, which I think that's a Hallmark card, to
Puck
be honest.
Puck her up, Buttercup. Puck her up, Maddie. Right. You just got the gig. That's why.
All right. So, all right. With that, ladies and gentlemen, let's start the show proper, shall we?
Here we go.
He's Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
Don't you give the guy a little bit of rope this year?
No.
Give him
no
rope.
No rope.
You want to see the guy that flops? He's, you know, the Faith No More video. That's the guy you want to see.
Are you kidding? Babcock's going to Bilesma this sucker.
Oh, yes. My Dick Tracy like good looks. Yes. The gentleman's parlor.
And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
I don't know if you know, but the Atlantic Division has been renamed as the Metropolitan Division. You have any thoughts about that?
Is it really?
Yeah.
He's a top-line player for the Carolina Hurricanes, and I still think of his Schwantz when I hear that name. I don't want to take a shit on the Devils. Rangers fans do that every day for me.
Debate hockey.
Can someone please break it to Phil? He's very sensitive. They always boo him in Boston.
This High Sticking Review brought to you by...
Well, listen, we're having
Cialis.
A debate.
Cialis, there it is.
We're having a
brought
debate.
Brought to you by Hard On Pills.
We're
this High Sticking.
We're having a debate, and this dissension is sponsored by Doritos.
Pop culture.
He's wound so tight, all right? Like Cameron Fry, the Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Lump of Coal, the Diamond. If he's wound that tight on the day of an exhibition game, probably not a good time to be wound.
Not a good time to be
wound. Not a good time to be
wound. No.
Merrick versus Wyshynski.
How do you fix the Flyers? Allison Jessing writes in, as a furloughed federal employee with nothing to do these days, I've had plenty of time.
Wow.
Full intro music. As a furloughed federal employee with anything to do these days, I've had plenty of time to come up with a plan I'd like to call the Red Wedding Solution. It's actually pretty simple. Phase one started today. Next, Homer is out, Hexie is in. After that, dismantle the goon squad, recruit median age talent, and stop trying to play like it's still 1976. They need to support their strongest players, Ginger Jesus, Voracek, Scott Hartnell's hair, with a talent pool, not thugs. The league has matured and progressed. The Broad Street Bullies' glory days are over when they can't skate fast enough to catch up with the other team. I say this as a diehard Flyers fan, with all the love my cold, stony heart is capable of. After I've had a few beers, we can talk about the goalie situation. Random Penguin, Philippe Durovel.
Hey, how are they a goon squad?
Well, they've still got the Zach Rinaldos of the world on roster. They've got Jay Rosehill. I tend to agree that I don't think that they're necessarily a goon squad.
It's a skilled team.
They've got some skill surrounding them, for sure, but they also have some dead weight.
I don't know. I mean, there's still a lot of young guys up front. I mean, the issue is the back end, as we've talked about. But they aren't playing like it's 1976 at all. This is a different team. This is a skating Philadelphia Flyers team.
All right, well, we'll pick that up after we get to the guest. Joining us now on the line, you know him, you love him, is the man we call Gabby. He is the head coach of your Anaheim Ducks. He is Bruce Boudreau, joining us here on Merrick versus Wyshynski. Mr. Boudreau, welcome back to the podcast, sir. It's Greg and Jeff. How are you?
Doing good this morning, thanks.
That's good to know. So what was your take on the Teemu Selanne Love Fest last night? Anything you can remember seeing that matched up with opposing fans lauding a visiting player like that?
No, you know what? He must have been so loved in Winnipeg, you know, the 3 years that he spent there. Because, I mean, they remember him after all this time. And, you know, the thing about T is he never turned down an autograph. It was 2:30 in the morning the night before. There was about 30, 40 people waiting for him at the hotel, and signed everything for them. And very gracious man. And I can see how everybody that crossed paths with him has sort of taken to him. So it was a fitting tribute, I thought, for a great player.
Did I see on the stat sheet that he skated with Perry and Getzlaff last night? Is that something you're going to be doing going forward, or was that a special team moves in Winnipeg kind of thing?
I think it was more of a one night thing. And you know what? It wasn't a question of, to be honest, of putting him up there with them, but the game he sat out the night before, we thought Perreault, Silverberg, and Penner played really good, so we just didn't want to break them up for that night. And, I mean, that's usually his line is Perreault, Silverberg, and Solani. So it was sort of a one-night thing.
Hey, Bruce, you know, I was watching the game last night, as we all were, you know, last hurrah in Winnipeg for Teemu Selänne, and you just mentioned, you know, how universally loved Teemu must be. And I got to thinking, you know, a lot of players, elite-level players, have had their detractors. I mean, Wayne did, Mario did, Bobby Orr, Rocket. I mean, all the top guys had their detractors. But when you talk about universally loved hockey players, there are two guys that are put up at the top of that list. One is Teemu Selänne, and the other is Jean Béliveau. Like, when you look at the history of the game, Bruce, and you know it, a lot you forgot more than we'll ever know. Can you think of more universally loved players and respected players more than those two guys that I just mentioned?
You know, and off the top of my head, I can't. And the reason, quite frankly, that jumped out of my mind when you said Béliveau was both of them are such ambassadors for the sport, and both of them are always, you know, like they take their time with the people. They don't rush through anything. I mean, I go to a lot of minor hockey games here because Timo's son is the same age as my son, and he sits in the stands and his team's parents, and he talks to everybody. Anybody that comes up to him, he's gracious. Now Béliveau was the same way. You've never heard anybody speak a bad word about John Béliveau. And Teemu, you know, I mean, hopefully when he is done, stays in the game as an ambassador like John did, or whatever he wants to do, he'll be great at it. So it's but two of the best guys, and I don't think you could have picked two better ones.
You can admit here on the podcast, Bruce, that you expect Teemu to come back for another 8 years, right? I mean,
you know what? I never know what to expect from him. He doesn't look any different than when I first got here. I mean, that first step, like, which usually is what goes on a hockey player, is not gone. He can go from blue line to red line as quick as anybody in the league. And his hockey IQ is very, very good. So, I mean, we expect him to be a big part of our team this year. And, you know, if he has a great year and we have a great year, it wouldn't surprise me where he comes into the office in June and going, you know, I don't know if this year was my last year.
Always curious about players, you know, in the back nine of their career, Bruce. What's he like as a practice player now at this point of his career?
You know what, he doesn't take anything off unless I tell him. He's out there, and if we're having a really hard practice, I mean, as we did a couple days ago, he's involved in everything. He doesn't ask for special treatment. I don't, you know, he does the skating at the end. If we're doing, you know, a bag skate at the end, he's right in there doing it and never complaining. So, I mean, as the season goes on, I'm going to insist that he take some practices off. But at this time right now, he's full bore ahead.
So. You have not dipped back too much into your pool of players from your Washington Capitals days insofar as acquisitions go. But there was the trade recently that brought Matthew Perreault to the Anaheim Ducks. What do you see in Perreault, and what did you want to bring over to Anaheim with Perreault?
Well, the one thing with Matty, he's extremely skilled. And sometimes, even when I had him in Washington or the continuous, when they had him after I was gone, we didn't utilize his skill well enough. But he was a guy we always thought could break out Like, I mean, he makes other people better. Alex Semin loved to play with him, so we thought that maybe Timo Solani would be a good fit for Matthew. And he's, you know, I mean, it's only been three games, but, I mean, he's done very well for three games. I mean, and he brings an energy type thing that we never had before. So we'll be utilizing him more and more. And I think I know him well enough to know, you know, how much ice time he can get and how much he can handle before it goes into he's over-censored or had too much and he can't play anymore. So, I mean, I got a good read on him, I think, that way.
Now, here's a question that maybe no one can really answer because we haven't seen a whole lot of them. The body work isn't there right now, Bruce, but what do you think the upside or what do you think the ceiling is for a player like Jacob Silfverberg?
Well, you know what? He's only 20 years old. I mean, the thing I love about Jacob, and if you saw his goal the other night in Minnesota, and he had an opportunity last night, it hits his stick and it's gone. Like, I mean, there is no hesitation. He's got such a quick release. He knows where to put himself in position to score. He's going to get stronger as the season goes on. I mean, all of training camp, he had an MCL sprain, so he's just getting into shape now. So, I mean, I think he's a really good find. Bob Murray did a great job in singling him out when we made the trade.
Now, Bruce, you, of course, made the highlight reels recently. A moment we'll never forget in which Patrick Waugh grabbed the glass partition and shook it violently in an argument with you. My question to you, were you surprised it took three periods for Patrick to grab the glass partition and shake it violently at you?
You know what? I don't know. It was all a surprising thing. But, you know, good thing it happened in game one, and it's all done. And we don't really talk about it around here. It's an isolated incident that I'm sure it's never going to happen again.
Within the coaching community, though, Bruce, like, do you guys see that and just kind of give a guy a pass as – you know, rookie coach, former player, adrenaline pumping, that kind of thing? I mean, is it a live and learn sort of thing, or is it like, oh, God, this guy is going to be doing this for the rest of the season?
Well, I don't think anybody's going to be doing it all the time. But, I mean, coaching is an emotional game, and he's an emotional person. So it's those things happen. I mean, they don't happen often, and hopefully I'm not involved in any more of them. But, you know, It's a tough gig, this coaching thing.
And it's high pressure. You ever been involved in something like that, like going back to like your IHL days in Fort Wayne or, you know, it was Manchester, Hershey, any other stops along the way, or was that the first time for you, Bruce?
No. I'll tell you the scariest moment that I had as a coach was in the East Coast Hockey League. And we were playing Baton Rouge one night, and there's a big brawl going on, and their other coach charged, it was the same kind of thing, and ran headfirst or ran right into the glass and was trying to climb the glass. Now, the scary part was it was Dave Schultz was the other coach. And if you ever want to see a coach cower yelling for the trainers and everything else, that was my part where, boy, I'm going, this coaching thing, it might not be the safest job in the world.
Oh, that's hilarious. Oh, that's good.
Hey, Bruce, as an old school guy, I mean, obviously one of the things we've all dealt with as hockey fans in the first couple of weeks of the season has been the reigniting of the fighting debate. Have your thoughts or opinions changed at all over the years insofar as fighting?
I don't think so. I mean, you know what? I don't know. Since I've been 4 years old, it's been in the game, so it's just been there. I mean, I didn't go through college hockey where you played without fighting or international hockey where there's no fighting. So to me, it's always been in the game. I mean, I think the debate will rage forever. I don't know if you can ever get it completely out of the game because it's such an emotional sport. Like, I mean, you know, there's no fighting in baseball, basketball, and football, yet there still is, you know, because it gets emotional and guys get into it. So I don't think no matter what rules put into place that a fight will not occur in hockey. So I'm just glad I'm not in them.
Well, what about the new icing rule? We saw, you know, Bogosian try to milk one yesterday, led to the game winner by Corey Perry. But where are you at on the new icing rule, Bruce?
You know, it really hasn't affected our team much. Like, I mean, but I could see where, you know, it's such a quick call. Like, I mean, the linesmen have got to be so, so sharp, and it's such a split-second decision for them that there's going to be mistakes made. But at the same time, if it, you know, standard answer, if it saves people from getting hurt, then I'm all for everything.
Bruce Boudreau, you are a gentleman and a scholar. Our final question for you today, of course, will bring us back to professional wrestling. three-match series between Bret the Hitman Hart and Ric Flair. Who would be victorious in that three-match series?
Well, I mean, are we talking WWE or are we talking the other one that was on?
We're talking both in their prime, at the height of their powers, a three-match series between Ric Flair and Bret the Hitman Hart.
Well, I'll always be Canadian, so it's got to be Bret the Hitman.
Oh, and the rest of the Four Horsemen weep. Bruce, you are the best, and thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you down the line, okay?
Thanks, Bruce.
All right, take care, guys. Okay, bye-bye.
The great Bruce Boudreau.
Yeah. It's one smart dude right there. I know he kind of him, and I guess Paul McLean is kind of the same way. They sort of play that sort of Colombo style of coach. You know, we just saw Paul McLean do it on the weekend. Oh, what do I know? I'm just a fisherman from Nova Scotia. I don't really know nothing about nothing. You know, Bruce kind of plays that, you know, everyday guy. Oh yeah, I'm just a coach. I just open and close the door. That guy knows more about hockey-ish. Yeah. To sit down with Boudreau for like an hour is like a hockey lesson. I'm serious when I say, like, that guy's forgotten more than I'll ever know.
No, it's the truth. And I think sometimes, I mean, listen, the man did an entire interview on HBO with barbecue sauce on his mouth. So
I don't think it was barbecue sauce, though.
What did you think it was?
No, he clarified that, though. Wasn't it a rash or something like that?
It was clearly a sauce of some sort. But
the point I'm trying
to make is that he is an approachable blue-collar guy, and sometimes those are the guys that you don't assume have the level of hockey expertise and knowledge as, oh, I don't know, say some bald guy with glasses who sits between the benches.
Every time it comes back to McGuire for you. You are obsessed with this man. Be like the Tai Chi guys in the park, man. Just let it go.
I've let it go. And listen, we have to stop talking about that because Keith Jones is going to come out in a second. So the point is that Bruce is fantastic. And you know, I noticed that on the stat sheet last night is that he played Solani up with Perry and Getzlaff. And,
yeah.
And I guess it is a one-game kind of thing, obviously trying to get him that goal. And that just goes to show you how awesome Solani is and how much that team adores the man. He comes back from injury, skates up with the top line, doing everything they can to give him that moment. He didn't get it. But obviously, you know what's funny, though? A lot of people have been loving the love fest that happened in Winnipeg for Solani. I was much more emotionally struck by his first game back. And maybe it's because it was also Winnipeg getting their team back and everything else. But his first trip back to Winnipeg, to me, was still much more special than his last.
It's true. Let's pick up the conversation because our guest is standing by, Mr. Wyshynski.
Joining us now on the line, a man who is going to tell us exactly how to fix the Philadelphia Flyers. He is Keith Jones of NBC Sports, NBC Sports Network, bringing you all of the analysis for the NHL you could possibly want. And he joins us here on the Merrick versus Wyshynski podcast. Hello, Keith. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you guys doing?
Doing well, man. Jonesy, did you have three games in the pool?
You know, it's strange and it's sad to say, but going into the weekend with the game in Montreal and the game coming up right back-to-back in Carolina, I had a sense that it might happen. And so much of it had to do with the preseason, more so than the opening game against the Maple Leafs, where the Flyers actually played well for the first period and a half before losing that one. The preseason did not go the way that it should have gone. They were a team that needed to win preseason games. As sad as that is to say, that's the case for the Flyers after not making the playoffs for one of the few times last year. There was a lot of pressure, and the team did not perform up to expectations. They dressed some pretty strong lineups in the preseason and had a couple of games, especially one in particular against the Devils, where a depleted Devils lineup dominated the Flyers, especially in their own zone, and that kind of set up the red flare gun for me.
You know, three games in, is it the case where this was Paul Holmgren's loyalty was really shown to be a fault? Because, as you know, Keith, I mean, the whispers were out there at the end of last season that don't be surprised if Peter Laviolette gets the punt. Is this a case where Homer was too loyal to a guy and just gave him one chance too many?
Yeah, I think loyalty played into it, without question. I think the lockout shortened season also played into the decision to keep Peter to start this season. I'm sure there was some conversations, and I'm sure it went through Paul Holmgren's mind to make the change at the end of last year, even prior to the end when the Flyers actually won a number of games at the end when they were eliminated from playoff contention. But that loyalty you knew was going to be on a short leash this season. You just had the sense being around the team. There was a real urgency to perform well to start the year. And, of course, with that not happening and with the Flyers' schedule coming up here, which does not get any easier, I think they looked at it as the time to make the switch and gave Peter the chance to get things started based upon the lockout shortened season and wanted to give him a full crack, but were unable to do so.
Yeah, exactly. Sir, you, of course, played with Craig Berube, if I'm not mistaken. Tell us what you know about him as a head coach in the National Hockey League.
Well, I know more about him as a person and a teammate. I played with him in Washington and Philadelphia. An outstanding teammate, protected me on many nights, and was one of the most beloved teammates I ever played with. Still one of my best friends, not just in hockey, but in the real world that we live in. Is an outstanding character person, an honest man that there is no gray area. The team will get the message loud and clear from what I've found from Craig as an assistant coach and also watching him closely for the short time as a head coach with the Phantoms. He knows the game. For a tough guy that played the way he did, he always understood the game. As a teammate, he was very vocal and also very educated. And I think that's going to serve him well as the head coach of the Philadelphia Flyers.
So what then, Keith, is the first order of business for Craig Berube? What does he need to do with his first practice?
He's got to get the team to play a more controlled game. They are helter-skelter on the ice, and when they score a goal, it's taken everything that they've got to get the goal. The game looks difficult right now. I don't think they're been a cohesive unit to start this year and really dating back to much of last year. He needs to get everybody, you know, focused. I think he needs to slow the game down. They need to come up with a different game plan to try to play to the strengths of the team and disguise some of the weaknesses.
Do you think that the move is made so quickly by Paul Holmgren because the quicker you make this move, the more chance there is that he might save his own job?
Well, there's no question. He's where everyone's looking now. The excuses have been removed. Ilya Brizgalov bought out, distraction number one taken out of the picture. Now the head coach has been replaced. So in the city of Philadelphia, all eyes and all fingers will be pointing towards Paul Holmgren. So it shows a great deal of confidence to go to Craig Berube in this situation, as maybe in some ways you could view it as his last lifeline as the general manager in Philly. Not sure if that's the case or not, but that's the speculation. I don't think it's lost on Homer that this team needs to win and win now, and they're going to have to find a way to do so, and he's going to, you know, use that final card, so to speak, with Craig Berube at the helm.
You know, Keith, for me, the answer, and like many, is the injury to Chris Pronger. But if you look at this team 2010 on, this team was in Game 6, as you all know, of the Stanley Cup Final. And right now it is, well, 0-3 and kind of in shambles right now. Is there one event, one trade, one signing, one whatever that Keith Jones can point to and say, this is the reason the Philadelphia Flyers are in the spot they're in right now?
You know, if he asked me in the summer, I would have been, you know, I would have been inclined to say the signing of Ilya Brizgalov, which turned into be a disaster. I think that played into it. But if you think back to the year that they went to the Stanley Cup Finals, they squeaked in on the last day of the regular season. And there was a lot of unevenness to their play during that 82-game regular season. They ended up getting in on a shootout and then went on that amazing run. Players like Billy Lehno were outstanding in the playoffs. He yep. moved on to Buffalo and has been a disaster there. Briere was awesome. His game dropped considerably in the couple of years after that. Scott Hartnell had unbelievable numbers, which he backed up the following year, but has had his play drop off. I can't really pinpoint one thing. There has not been a lot of consistency to their game, even including the Stanley Cup run when they got to the finals in 2010.
Interesting stuff. Well, Keith Jones, we can't have you on the show and simply bombard you with Flyers questions. There's an entire league out there to discuss with you. And I wanted to bring up fighting, because that's all anybody's talking about in the first few weeks of the season. Have your feelings on fighting changed at all in the last maybe 3 or 4 years? As many claim their feelings have changed due to new information about player safety and brain injuries, that whole thing. Have your thoughts on fighting changed?
They do momentarily when I see an injury to George Parros, when I see a player like Rytus Evenons get knocked out and never play again with one punch from Steve McIntyre. But I get over it quickly, and it's sad to say, but I enjoy it. I still get excited with the thought of a fight breaking out. I still love rivalry games that are built upon good, tough hockey and the occasional five-on-five brawl. My personal opinion is that I would be disappointed if it was removed. I would understand the viewpoint of those pushing to get it removed, but I still like it and want it to stay.
Having said that, too, if it's a player safety issue, and I can understand the argument for player safety, and although this may be a chalk and cheese comparison, I look at blocking shots to be way more dangerous, Keith, than getting in a fight.
It's interesting. It's a great point. And, you know, the big curves on the stick contribute to the puck being elevated that much faster, too. I mean, there's all kinds of different things that you could tweak to try to make it a safer game, but as enjoyable of a game or as tough of a game. You need breaks to stay in the game. You know, we're talking about fighting. Look at how many fighting majors Craig Berube had, and I never saw him miss a game with a concussion. I mean, he had a lucky head. I mean, that's how tough he was. I don't know if there's many players that fought as much as Chief did. And he just kept on going, and he took punches from the biggest heavyweights to ever play the game. Mm-hmm. And fortunately for him, you know, he was able to sustain those hits and continue on.
And I guess last thing for me, Keith Jones, is I was a little bit surprised the players approved hybrid icing. I didn't think that was going to happen for the season. But then all of a sudden they pass it and it's involved in the game. What are your thoughts on it? And do you think it's something that will work out this season?
I was surprised also. I find it a little bit confusing from the viewpoint of explaining it to fans during games when I'm televising them. It's still a work in progress in my own mind of trying to, you know, pinpoint exactly why one was called and one wasn't. I think there's added judgment to the referees who have enough judgment in their games, in my opinion. So I do think it's going to take time. I understand that I watched Pat Peake right in front of me shatter his heel racing for an icing against Pittsburgh years ago. Saw Yoni Pitkins last year. I get it, but I was surprised that they put it in the way it was. I'd rather see it be an all or nothing situation. And just use the touch up and, you know, and just whistle it and send it down the ice. I had no problem with that, but I'm not so keen on the in between.
And then last one here, Keith, and we thank you for your time. We just talked to Bruce Boudreau a second ago, and a lot of it revolves around Teemu Selanne. Your thoughts on the Finnish forward who's on the victory lap of his career, Keith?
I just love the guy. I've always enjoyed any second that I've had the opportunity to spend with him, including playing against him, and a great appreciation for the joy that he brought to the game, the smile that he had in his face during, after. Just seems to really pass that on in his life, and he'll be missed for sure. Amazingly talented player, but more than that, it was just that beaming smile that just said to everybody around him that we have a great game, and that he was really pleased to be part of it.
Amen.
Great stuff, Keith Jones, ladies and gentlemen of NBC Sports Network, and you also do Comcast, right? You do the Flyers games as well?
I did. I was doing the game yesterday against Carolina, and after the first period, I kind of thought that we might have a long day today.
You're a busy man. Thanks for joining us, taking time out to join us on the podcast, and we will talk to you soon, sir.
No worries, guys. Take care.
Keith Jones.
You know, it's funny about Teemu Selanne, too. I think when I talked about this last year on the show, can you think of someone who scored more goals and had a softer shot than Teemu Selanne? And it's accurate as all hell. His placement is perfect with his shot. It's deceptive, but, you know, I remember talking to one of his ex-teammates who said, dude, he can barely break a plane of glass. I mean, it's a muffin. It's a muffin, this guy.
Never been a howitzer, and that's one of the more remarkable things about him. I'm not going to belabor the fighting point because we talked about it ad nauseum last week, and a lot of people got pissed off because we didn't offer a lot of opposing viewpoints or what have you. But, like, again, we just had two hockey guys on that were in the game, that played the game. In Boudreau's case, he still coaches the game. And I'm sorry. I defy anybody on the other side of the argument to say that these guys don't understand its place in the game. Like, that you understand, Keyboard Warrior, its place in the game better than Bruce Boudreau does.
One of the things that I find insulting is the way that people dismiss ex-players like Keith Jones or coaches like Bruce Boudreau when they come across as pro-fighting. But the way it's completely dismissed is, well, they're just, you know, pro-Magnon, brain-dead moral. Actually, I'm doing a blog about this, going to put up tomorrow on
Sports. Wait a second. A what?
A blog post on Sportsnet.ca. I'm starting a weekly tomorrow on
Mr. Pancake Makeup Suit Wearing Merrick coming down to Mom's basement to write a blog.
Well, I did move my office to the basement. That's where I am right now, so I might as well keep up with it. but the essential point of the piece is how, you know, there's no debate going on right now, and the amount of, you know, juvenile sort of name calling from both sides does nothing to further the debate. You know, it's either you're a dinosaur or you're a dove. Right? There's no actual debate that's happening. Every side has their position, and all they're looking for is ammunition right now. And Larry Brooks jumped into it yesterday saying, you know, the pro fighting crowd, all they can do is resort to name calling. Well, so does the other side. Like, what does it do for the discussion when you have, you know, anti-fighting people calling pro-fighting people, you know, dinosaurs or anti-intellectual? What does that do for the discourse? Like, what does that do for the debate? It does nothing other than polarize others. Like, there is a case to be made for banning fighting. Personally, I don't agree with it, but there is a case to be made. And there are, you know, legitimate concerns that the other side does have. I don't agree with them, but I will listen to their points. But right now, the way that the debate is framed right now, it's like conservative talk radio. Get your point, dig in your heels, and start throwing grenades.
Right. And it becomes a situation where, like, I got into it with Bruce Arthur over the weekend, where the other side can simply just say brain injury, and then that's the be-all, end-all. As you pointed out before, you can get a brain injury from blocking a shot. You can get a brain injury from taking an elbow.
Ask Philadelphia Flyers assistant coach Ian LaPerriere what brain injuries are like with blocking shots.
But I get the idea that if you ban fighting, you are banning at least one avenue towards a you know, life-threatening brain injury. I get that. But it doesn't mean that we're going to make the game safe. It doesn't mean that we're going to be protected from all of it. And the one, again, just not to belabor the point, the one thing I was trying to say about Yzerman, okay, vis-a-vis hypocrisy, is if you're going to frame this thing as a player safety debate, and your safety as a player was ensured by Probert, Kosher, Grimson, McCarty. Now, even though McCarty wouldn't necessarily have the fight log that Probert had, yeah. McCarty's job was that same type of role, then you have to acknowledge that your safety as a player was enhanced by fighting when you were playing. If you're going to frame it as a player safety debate, you cannot simply dismiss what fighting does for player safety. And that was my problem with Iserman.
Here's the problem, too, is if there are more severe penalties for fighting, game ejections, major suspensions for the act of dropping the gloves, we don't know what goes in that void. Like, we were talking to Bedini about this on Fight, and his point I thought was a great one. We're really dealing with a hypothetical here. We just don't know what will happen. We can speculate all we want, but I think it's folly to think you can just remove fighting and that there are no ripple effects.
Yeah,
you know, the butterfly
exactly.
flaps its wings in China, and you know, there's a monsoon in Florida.
And like, listen, I'm listening to everybody on Twitter and stuff, and like, I'd like nothing more than to have Lozo on or to have Proto on.
We should
or one
have
of those
them
cats.
On. We should.
Well, yeah, but do we really need? I mean, like, it's obviously going to be a handicap match. I mean, you and I are like-minded on fighting. Proto's not.
Here's the problem with it, though, Wish. I find the conversation boring. It's dull.
I don't find the conversation boring. I just feel like it devolves into AM talk radio if we have if we bring that debate on. But maybe that's what people want. I don't know. We'll see what we'll do. Maybe we'll have Lozo or Proto on later this week to talk about fighting.
I'm happy to have those two dudes on for sure.
It's just you know, to bring the clear stalemate in this argument to the airwaves is there's a part of me that would love to, and there's a part of me that's like, what's the point? You know what I mean?
Hey, so. I'm cool to have Proto on. We haven't had Proto on the podcast yet. When I used to do Hockey in Canada Radio, I had Proto on like every 2 weeks. I miss talking to the dude. We disagree on things, but I miss talking to the guy.
One thing that obviously Merrick and I do agree on is how awesome the shootout is. wanted to talk about Spinoramas for a second because, you know, as you know, Paul McLean had a problem with Mason Raymond's Spinorama recently. In a Sens-Leafs game. And listen, as much as I hate the shootout, and I hate it, I am one of these people that says, if we're going to have it, let's just do it all the way to its ridiculous end, okay? Take the helmets off, allow everything, scoring by any means necessary. The idea that we sit here and try to apply logic, rules, regulations, moral codes in some cases when it comes to guys like Linus Omark showing off. The fact that we try to apply all this stuff to a skills competition is asinine. It's a thing that exists to artificially end games and generate highlights to watch on SportsCenter. That's the only reason it's around. It's not important enough to be in the playoffs. We're going to just have it, then make it fun and allow someone to do a dopey spinorama even if the puck stops moving.
First of all, and one of the reasons there is a shootout is so games can get, you know, games can be ended in a timely fashion. Each team has 82 of these suckers, and they want to get the game times in around between 2:20 and 2:25.
No, I agree,
that is what they want.
To artificially end the game. You're right.
Which is fine. Okay, so you want like endless overtime, or you want ties?
I'm cool with
ties, dude. We've had this discussion before. I'm Canadian. I'm fine with ties. It's a Canadian 2-2 is the ultimate Canadian score.
I've given my shootout. I have two solutions to the shootout problem. My two alternative takes are: you go 4-on-4, and then you go 3-on-3, and in 3-on-3, you're undoubtedly going to have a goal. Or if you wanted to scrap the entire thing and just do a thing where you trade 5-on-3 power plays, giving the home team the first strike, I'd be fine with that too. My big thing on this is always going to be return the game to team hockey. You've played team hockey for 60 minutes, 65 with an overtime. Don't end the game with an individual skills competition. Philosophically, that's always going to be my problem with the shootout.
Okay, then I go back to my point that we talked about on the podcast with Dello last year and Helen. Do the shootout before the game. So the tiebreaker is already set.
That's fine. If you want to do it that way, I'm sure that's fine. Although that obviously doesn't bring the cathartic end to the game that people like.
sure it does. When you know that if it's a tie game, that this team already has a tiebreaker.
But
playing like, and they're playing like hell to win the game.
But then again, it also fundamentally changes the outcome of the. I mean, it changes how teams will approach the game. I don't know if that's
it's
a good
true.
Thing or a bad thing.
Okay, but anyway, to the point about the Spinorama, because we're getting off topic here. The thing about the Spinorama and the debate rage we saw, you know, Mason Raymond with Craig Anderson throwing the goalie, ass in the face, the whole deal, the Paul McLean press conference afterwards. What always sort of doesn't boggle my mind, because I know the nature of what hockey is. And hockey, when it comes really right down to it, is a very conservative place that is definitely afraid of change, of moving anything an inch to the right or an inch to the left. Like the amount of ink spilled and words blathered about how a lot of hockey pundits can't stand the showiness of the shootout, how that's got to go. Really? That's the main concern about this thing, is that it's too showy, it's too glamorous, that, you know, it's an affront to quote unquote decent hockey. Why don't you just come in and take a shot? Why don't you just come in like Brian Rolston and just or Marian Hossa, just come in and wind up and take a good old fashioned slap shot? To me, the minute they brought in the shooter, the first thing I thought was, okay, this is Robbie Schrempf time. This is the time. And yes, is it there for highlights? Absolutely. For sure it's there for highlights. And we've got some great highlights out of it. Listen, how much has, editor-in-chief of Puck Daddy, how much has Puck Daddy dined out on great shootouts?
Oh, we've definitely run our share of highlights, for sure. I mean, but that's the whole point of its existence, is to generate highlights and to allow players to do funny little tricks.
And to end games in a timely fashion, because everyone insists that we must have a winner. And your 4-on-4 and your 3-on-3 doesn't guarantee a winner. Now, most times there will be a winner, but what happens if there isn't? The NHL needs a way to guarantee a win. I don't like that. I'm a tie guy. I'm cool with ties. But if you're going to have a way to end games, I'm sorry, the quote-unquote pure way, the 82-game edge-to-the-end schedule, ain't going to work. It's not.
Indeed. Well, that's our shootout debate.
We still got a good one coming. That's just a little flavor puck. There's more coming. We got a whole game of shootout.
Here are a few responses to the question of the day, which, of course, is how do you fix the Flyers? First off, one about the future of Peter Laviolette. Ben Glissman writes in, Lavi2...Nashville? Trotz is the longest tenured coach in the NHL. 14 seasons, 7 playoff runs, never gotten past the second round. If the Predators keep underperforming this season, do you see Nashville finally giving old Barry the boot, especially now that there is a coach available with a cup win and another cup final appearance on his resume?
Yeah, it's going to happen one day. It's going to happen eventually. Oh, by the way, spot quiz. Who's the second longest tenured coach right now?
In the NHL?
Yeah. I'll throw a dart.
Babcock?
You got it, 2005. He is.
Hey, all right.
The second longest tenured coach in the NHL. I mean, it's going to happen one day. It's got to happen one day. So, sure. I mean, if this team keeps underperforming. By the way, speaking of Nashville, you see the ice that Seth Jones rocked on the weekend?
No, I did not.
24 minutes.
More than
Shea Weber.
Is that all?
No way.
Matthew Toy, assuming the role of Ed Snyder, I fire Holmgren, hire Laviolette back, hire Messier as general manager, and trade Couturier for a defenseman. Love him, but love him less than Shen and Simmons, and someone has to go. Couturier the odd man out in that group, you think?
Boy. And to think they could have had PK Subban for Sean Couturier 2 years ago. Yeah, I mean, it's going to come down to him or Braden Schenn. Take your pick. Don't you think those are the two, you know, young centermen that are circled on the Flyers?
Yeah, I think so. Fred Forsberg. Flyers' fortunes and misfortunes seem to be so closely tied to the wishes of Ed Snyder that I don't really think they are fixable. At the same time, the team has no identity. What are the Flyers? What type of players do they bring in? It seems like Homer is like a kid without impulse control in a toy shop. He wants everything, including the astronaut Barbie, madness, and from a distance, enjoyment.
Now, I grew up in Toronto, and there was an owner by the name of Harold Ballard, whom I am buried at Park Lawn Cemetery, Section AA, right at the corner of Prince Edward and Bloor, for those who care to go and visit. And it was a fun time. Now, at the time, I mean, if you're a fan of the Maple Leafs, it's kind of a drag because the way they dismantled the team and went to over Sittler and McDonald and everything and all that. But it was, to me, a more interesting team because one single guy, as crazy as Harold may have been, owned it and ran it and kind of ran it at times on a whim. Depending on how he woke up that morning, that was how the deal was going to happen to the team. And that's kind of it's becoming a dying thing in sports, don't you think?
Yeah.
And you know, it's more like, look at the Maple Leafs now. I mean, it's owned by, what, Bell and Rogers. Larry Tannenbaum with a minority interest as well. But I still like the idea, maybe as, you know, non-practical as it can seem at times, as the quote-unquote crazy owner who still wants to be able to make roster decisions.
By the way, I prefer to think of it as the Leafs being owned by Rogers and Bell. I don't know if you knew, very much.
Yeah, oh, yeah, thanks, like that. Nice distinction there. But, you know, but it's true, though. Like, and the thing is now, with so many, you know, we're not dealing with, like, $1 million. We're dealing with $50 million for contracts. Like, we're dealing with, like, some significant money. Where once upon a time, an owner could say, you know what, run the team. Here's your budget, $2 million for payroll. Go. I mean, now, you know, $60 million for payrolls.
Yeah,
maybe
right.
$70 million next year. Should it surprise anyone that the general manager or director of player personnel or the director of hockey operations has to go to the owner for his input before asking him for a check? Doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, right. And then finally, this one from Nathaniel Siegel. I think this is an interesting one. Practically speaking, an addiction to bad contracts means they cannot easily improve through personnel changes. With that in mind, they need to play a more defensive style. Goaltending has managed to not be their number one problem so far, but that can't last. This also lets Holmgren say that Laviolette's firing was something other than a scapegoating. Random Penguin, Tony Feltrin. I think that's an interesting idea, but I don't know if a defensive... I don't know if they bought in, like, Guy Boucher, let's say, you know, or somebody like that. If that style plays in Philly, because Philly, here's what Philly is, unlike many other American hockey cities, that's a town with pressure. That's a town where the media pays attention and where hockey can become an afternoon drive time topic if the Eagles aren't playing and if the Phillies suck. So there is a bit of expectation about these teams, and I don't know if necessarily that style of hockey will thrive there.
I wonder, you know, it is interesting. And I mean, every market has a different way they want the game to be played. And maybe this goes back to 74, 75, when actually, interestingly enough, was Bernie Parent that won the Stanley Cups. Have Flyers fans been brought up on a diet of goals and fights? That's how we're going to win games. Mm-hmm. I mean, they still carry the Broad Street Bullies reputation, but also, this was a team, whether it was, you know, Clark or McLeish or Reggie Leach or Bill Barber, this is a team that scored a lot of goals and has always been a team that's, you know, sort of prided itself on having, you know, big name players, Eric Lindros and Michael Renberg and John LeClair and now Claude Giroux, of scoring big time goals. Is that what that market craves? And maybe to the person that tweeted in, is it time for them to rethink that and re-educate that marketplace that's not how we're going to win right now?
Could be.
Or do you just see it, you know what? That is Philadelphia Flyers hockey. That's how we're going to win. I mean, which team has the greatest identity in hockey right now? For me, it's the Boston Bruins. I mean, how many times have you said, yeah, that guy's not going to fit. He doesn't play Bruins hockey. He doesn't play that style. I mean, one of the reasons why Tyler Seguin is not with the Bruins anymore is he's not a Boston Bruins type player. He doesn't fit that quote unquote culture. Philadelphia Flyers, is it goals and fights?
Either the Bruins or the Red Wings, I think, have identity right now.
That's true. Yep. Throw the Red Wings in there. Yep, you're right.
And that might be the Devils used to have it, but I don't know. I don't know if, like, I don't know if
the Devils to me this year are the most interesting. By the way, Schneider returns to Vancouver this week. Pay attention to that one.
Oh, and by the way, not playing tonight in Edmonton, so ready to play in Vancouver?
Oh, I'm doing that game tonight, the Edmonton, New Jersey game. Stand back. Ryan Smith is a scratch. You see that one, Wish?
Yeah, and as I said on Twitter, I don't know how anyone could call him a healthy scratch. Like, doesn't he just lose?
A lot of miles, not a miles on that body.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, New Jersey to me is a team that anything could happen to them this year, and I wouldn't be surprised. They could, you know, they could totally bottom out and draft Aaron Ekblad or the Reinhardt kid from out west, and it wouldn't surprise me. Or,
well,
they could find themselves winning two rounds of the playoffs.
It would surprise me because they don't have a pick.
Great. I wish. Okay, you know what? Forget that then. Okay, bottoming out and not getting a pick.
they can bottom out and watch someone else pick Ekblad. No, but yeah, I'm the same way. Like, I picked them to be a playoff team only because the moment you count them out is the moment they wind up doing something of note. They've got the goaltending. I don't quite. Bruner was great against the Islanders. That was a bit of a surprise. But I'm not quite sure how the goal scoring is going to come together. But overall, I mean, that with the Flyers were picked by many people not to be a playoff team, and I think this probably is a nail in the coffin. This coaching change. I don't think it's one that's going to turn around the season all that well. So you never know what's going to happen in the Metropolitan Division. But I'm with you, man. The Devils are a complete X factor as far as what they're going to be. And in one game, they potted a bunch of goals. In the other game, they looked baffled by Marc-Andre Fleury. So we'll see how things shake out.
Or they just may be, at the end of the season, the ultimate spoiler. That one team is like, oh, man, we need a point today. But damn it, we're playing the frickin' New Jersey Devils.
They're always going to be a tough out. And by the end of the season, Schneider will be playing every game. So
hey, one thing we should mention as well, Lars Eller, Alexander Galchenyuk, Brendan Gallagher, the egg line. To me, it's the best line I've seen so far in the NHL this year. You?
Very well could be, yeah, absolutely. And great to see Gallagher pick up from last season. He was a guy that was, I picked him to win the Calder last year, if memory serves. But yeah, a very exciting line, a very cool line to watch, and clearly a potential powerhouse, an offensive engine for your Montreal Canadiens.
Lars Eller, your breakout player of the year? Early review, but.
Jesus Christ, Merrick, we're, what, 3 games into the season?
Yeah, that's right, man. We had a podcast to do every single day.
Andrew Hirsch, by the way, with Roman Josi on the shelf for an unknown amount of time. Barry Trotz had 19-year-old Seth Jones skating along Shea Weber at Monday's practice, indicating they'll likely be the team's top pairing for Tuesday's home opener against Minnesota.
Yeah, and they had, they sort of primed for this by having Shea Weber, Seth Jones' right-hand shot play the left side in a lot of preseason as well. So I think that was the minute that Tampa took Drouin, and David Poile said, really, did we get Seth Jones? I think the long-term plan was always put Seth Jones with Shea Weber.
Yep. And I just hope that Shea Weber can hang back and play the defensive rock role as Seth Jones skates up and down the ice and gets his offense on, because clearly that's how it'll all work out, right?
Yeah, what the American guy said.
Of course. All right, everybody, thank you for joining us today on the Merrick versus Wyszynski podcast. Merrick on the phone. And I thought,
how did it sound?
Better than you'd expect. I think you have a better phone than I do when I try to pull off the same thing.
And now you know what? Because the music is so hot in my ear on the phone, I can't hear you, Wish, so you do the sign off.
All right. Thanks for joining us, Merrick. And hey, thanks everybody for hanging in there with usual technical challenges. Thanks to Bruce Boudreau for joining us. Thanks to Keith Jones for joining us on a day in which we sound like an actual radio show with high-profile guests instead of having, like, Leahy and Mooney on. Thanks to Matt Brown for making all of these guests happen today. That was very exciting. And there you have it. Puck Daddy today, Jersey Fouls coming up later today. It's been way too long. And also all that fun stuff. Look out for Merrick's blog that evidently is a thing over on Sportsnet. And we will talk to you on the morrow. Bye, everybody.
Thank you.